Also, Guy Blanchard wrote some information in the chat you might like to read, Laura. Could be applicable.
Where are we? Chat.
Okay. Okay. Well, it looks like our board is here and Shifty is here. And
Milestones. Thank you. Milestones. That's very good.
Okay. So I would like to call this meeting to order. First, I would like to read a statement about owner's approval. A property can be nominated by someone other than the owner, but the law requires that owners must be notified of the nomination. Notification cover letter provides instructions on how private property owners can concur with or object to the proposed nomination. The law allows them the right to object to the listing of the property and request a contested case hearing. Okay, and then the first item on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. I would like to propose that the Hawaii Employers Council be moved to first on our list of nominations to be considered in order to accommodate the Attorney General's office. Does anybody else have any questions or comments on the agenda? Okay, somebody make a motion to approve the agenda as revised.
I'll move to approve the agenda as revised.
Second.
Great, thank you.
Hang on a second. Yes. I'm sorry. And this is a question for Linda as well. The Hawaii Employees Council cannot be on right immediately. They need a few minutes to get on. So can we move it to the second item?
Sure, that's fine.
So since there's a motion, there would have to be an amendment to the motion.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, amend the motion.
Can we withdraw it and make a new one?
Well, I think Dr. Donner said the amended motion would be okay. So Alton's proposing to amend it to move the Hawaii Employers Council to second on the agenda. Is that correct, yes. Alton? Okay.
Yes.
Thanks. Do I have a second? Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. All in favor of approving the agenda as revised? Okay. That's unanimous. Thank you. Next is the meeting minutes, and these are actually approved in yesterday's meeting. I think we're okay with those, and we'll move into our nominations to be considered for today's meeting. The first on the list would be the Ikeuchi and Sons property, which is Laura Ruby. It's all you, Laura.
Okay, thank you very much. I need to screen share just a second. Okay, are you okay? Are you seeing just my one screen? You're not seeing both screens?
Yes.
Just one screen. Okay, yeah, because the other screen I have the nomination up. Okay, the Bunzo Ikeuchi and Sons Incorporated property is a very crucial corner of Honoka'a. You can see it here. This is basically the original building that's been there for probably almost 100 years. We had a little bit of trouble when the streets were realigned and the front facades were probably moved out, but I think this happened all up and down the street. There were a lot of kapakahi buildings prior to the time that it looks like today, but it's been this way, and I'll show you some photos in just a minute. It's in Haina Ahupua'a. It's an important intersection of the government road and the road Makai to the Haina Mill and Mauka to Waimea. Haina Mill actually goes down to the Honoka'a Landing also. The government road, of course, is now called Mamani Street, and that's government roads were called government roads all over Hawaii. And a quick history of the peoples here, which is a very interesting conjunction at this with this family and with this hardware store, it was initial sparse settlement of Native Hawaiians on the Waena lands of the Hamakua district, the middle lands, basically. Early European and Americans began commercial agriculture in the mid 19th century. Chinese immigrants came to work on the plantations, later to become entrepreneurs and intermarrying with Hawaiians. Japanese immigrants, making up the largest ethnic group, came to work on the plantations and soon became entrepreneurs. Korean and Filipino immigrants followed also to work on the plantations. Now, why do I mention the history of the peoples? Is because the Ikeuchi family is this history of the peoples, all and their through their intermarriage. And the location, just to familiarize you with our many property submissions, but in the up in the Hamakua Coast, and the center is the a very old map, Haina, Ahupua'a. All these Ahupua'as are only about like 1,000 feet wide, very narrowly cut up and distributed. And then this is a larger map of Haina, and you can see the red a rectangle. That's where the intersection is, where the Ikeuchi hardware store is. And again, you can see the corner. It was the meeting place of everybody in the immediate area. So it was a very important location. And another one showing where it is today. And this is the TMK, and originally from a grant from a royal patent grant from Kalakaua to William Rickard. And it's now listed, of course, as the Ikeuchi, B. Ikeuchi and Sons Inc. property. And Google Map, the only difference here is the Google Map is on the old side. They need to update their Google Maps because the awning covering the back entrance to the hardware store is now no longer there. And this is a layout of the property with the store. Most Mauka, and this is Mamani Street, as you can see, and Leihua Street. It was originally the Mill Road, but when they straightened out the streets, then they gave it names. All the names in Honoka'a have tree names. And the residence, the orchard house, and the paint warehouse. And these are the plan views of the hardware store. And I'm just showing you that they're using every available space that's here. All of the diagonal shading is mezzanine, where, as I'll show you in some of the photos, the tools and every other supply is stashed there. And the Ikeuchi residence itself was originally located coming off of the more Makai area of the hardware store. And then when Bunzo purchased the property, it was turned around 90 degrees so that the entrance is really off of Leihua Street here. And at the same time, they lifted up the building. And so this is way back in the 20s we're talking about. And so the living room and bedroom areas on the upper stair floor, and the downstairs is dining and living area and a lot of the other smaller, lesser rooms. And this is to show you what I believe, and we don't know exactly because there were no street addresses in Honoka'a. Everybody just knew where everybody was. But this, the large rectangle on the left, is the places where Chinese entrepreneurs had their first shops. And this was also a Chinese owned, or leased, I should say, shop at the time that Bunzo was actually starting to work for them. And then over here is the great big restaurant that was on the front East Street. This is the Japanese map, and it's already showing when the man created this that there were really more Japanese enterprises set up. And just to give you the background, the commercial structure rests on a concrete foundation. The walls are of tongue and groove, single board construction. The roof is totan. The residential structure, Makai, of the commercial space is two stories, reflecting the slope of the parcel. The residential structure has a concrete floor and walls and posts which support the upper floor. The walls are of tongue and groove, single board construction. The roof is totan, corrugated iron. The commercial building remains in good condition and retains its massing, scale, and such character defining elements as the structure's front elevation windows, doors, shed roofed or pent roofed awning, and false front with its bracketed cornice. And the residential structure also remains in good condition. The Ikeuchi property is eligible for the Hawaii and National Registers of Historic Places at the local level under Criterion A and Criterion C due to its continuous significance in small town commerce and its period architecture. And I might just say that really Bunzo Ikeuchi was an entrepreneur for over 100 years now. I mean, he's passed on, of course, but the store building itself, which he purchased in 1926 to his death, is our defining period in time. Under Criterion A, History and Events, the B. Ikeuchi Sons property, incorporated property is significant at the local level under Criterion A, as the structures typify the hard work of immigrants to improve their economic status. It is also a coming together of Hawaiian, Hawaiian Chinese, and Japanese ethnic backgrounds. Under Criterion C, architecture, the B. Ikeuchi Sons Incorporated property is significant at the local level under Criterion C as a good example of plantation era architecture, wood, commercial, and residential buildings constructed in Hawaii during the opening decades of the 20th century. The property retains its integrity and so is an excellent example of a structure purely for business purposes with an adjacent rear residence. The property retains its historical integrity in terms of location, design, setting, materials, workmanship, feeling, and association. And if you wish, I can go into that more. But this is the front facade of the hardware store over time. This is probably right on when Bunzo purchased the property himself. And I think these are written in by himself, and he colorized the photo. So. But you can see the residence behind, which has already been turned around. And it's often that people have their, you know, opening, maybe not opening days, but almost opening days photos taken of their buildings and themselves. To the right is the about 1940s. And you can see that there's where there was a concrete slab, there's an addition here under the pent roof. Awning, and that is where the pipes were. And then down in the lower left is apparently they felt that they, this is about the 1970s, they should enclose it. Maybe it was the weather was probably pretty major that made them enclose it. And then finally, it's fully enclosed now because they don't really have the pipe supplies in there, but they have other supplies that during heavy storms, they really wouldn't want to get their merchandise wet. And this is, again, this is a front facade. These are the double doors. This is the back where at another later time was the pipe storage rack behind. And this just shows the Lehua side right here. And this, if you haven't been in here, this will really amaze you because this is everything you ever wanted to get with hardware and everything else in here. And to me, one of the most fascinating things is this bolts and screws. Set of drawers, and it was likely made by Bunzo himself. And you can pull out, and every possible bolt or screw that you want is there. But it's just a really, I have never seen one like this anywhere else. So I thought it was really a pretty special item. And then you can just see, I'm just going to point you in. This is looking in the cabinet is right over here, but inside here is as you walk in, walking into the other side, the more to the your Waipio side or your left side is walking straight to the counter where the sales take place. But also, it's all about pipes and fittings and everything back there too. And these other two show you that there's the open rafters and there is the and. Everything is really the mezzanines, which have all kinds of items. This was probably the first divider. It's not actually a wall that separates anything. It just divides slightly, probably Bunzo's first as hardware and also as tinsmith owner. And this is Bunzo in his first store, we think, either first or second store. You can note it's not of the store that I'm showing you now because the canic ceiling is there and that was from an earlier store. Also, it looks like very many imported things probably from Japan are also in the store. And that's just, these are all series of tools, of which I've used not these tools, but ones like them, workbenches, bending tool, shear, wire bending, pipe threading. This is a T-chest that would carry smaller items. These are all located outside the hardware store now, as the as you can tell, the shift has been to have goods for people coming in with all varieties of things. And plumber, you know, just shows his different times listings are slightly different, whether plumbing, sheet metal, hardware, paint store, all of those things. This is the residence, and this is the Lehua facing front, the side to the immediately to the store. And this is the back sort of covered lanai area, and the other part of the back, it's, you can't really get in there. It's very tight to get in there. And then this is, these are just some of the details, the topiary that leads right from the store into the lanai here and into the upper floor entrance. This is the lanai from a different point of view. It was never intended to be a carport. It's just a lanai that has a interesting shape to get you up to the upper floor. And then this is the pond where Bunzo raised fish and a little waterfall and everything. And interior wise, these are original built cabinets. This is the upstairs one with special gifts they've collected. And the lower floor is the where that might be for special occasions or something like that, where the really the kitchen is. This is the lower floor. And you can tell that it is the posts that support the upper floor are there. And then this is the top floor also. And you can see that tongue and groove vertical siding. And this is interesting because this is actually extant, but it's a little bit higher grade furo than the other ones. Most of them were done in redwood, but this was a built-in tiled piece. And so you would come into the shower room here and you would be able to, I'm not quite sure what this all entailed, but it might be ashes or something to take out ashes. These fire bricks were probably extras from the mill down the road. And so here's the furo. And then this is outside on the covered lanai area, which is actually where the fire was stoked. And it went into the furo right here. Oh, right over here is the box where the wood was kept. This is no longer in use, but it's still there. And the orchid building, it's, I should say, it's almost a structure because it's built in a very open ventilated walls with a clear totan. Well, that is a plastic totan because it's to let the light in. So very much. And they raised all kinds of plants there. Bunzo was an avid orchid raiser and won competitions, as well as the anthuriums that are there were also award-winning ones. And this is the paint shed. Notice that he, let me go back just one. Okay. This you can't see it, but this is all metal, tinsmith, metalworking. So when you come to, you see this is the, he simply enclosed the whole of the building in tin and totan. And that's because it's the paint warehouse. That's for safety reasons. And this is the census, and you can see his first two daughters from his first marriage are there, and then the younger ones take over the business. And I'm showing you this, I don't usually put genealogy in, but because as I was suggesting earlier, it's really a melding, a coming together of all the ethnic backgrounds. So the Bunzo is Japanese and Japanese American. And then over on the side, on this side here, it's Daisy, who married Walter, is part Chinese, part Chinese Hawaiian, and Japanese and Hawaiian. So it's a coming together, so that these two brothers ran the store after Bunzo. So they're the sons. after Bunzo retired, I think. And then today, Alan and Susan are Walter's children, and they continue to run the store as proprietors. So you can see the orchids here from Bunzo's, and then this is a portrait of the family home. So this, just to summarize, the property meets the registration requirements set forth in the multiple property submission, historical and architectural resources of Haina'ahupua'a, Hamakua District, Honoka'a Town, Hawaii Island, Hawaii, type plantation vernacular commercial and plantation vernacular residence. The justification of the period of significance began with Ikeuchi purchasing the property in 1926, and from that time, following the death of Bunzo in 1971. It was the end of the historical period. The store building has served commercial purposes as a purveyor of general hardware and mercantile goods. Its plantation style commercial building today retains all the major characteristics of the original building's architecture. Likewise, the residence building also retains all the major characteristics of the original building's architecture. It's significant at the local level under A, serving as an incubator for the entrepreneurial dreams of Japanese immigrants to find employment off the plantations and establish their own enterprises. Period of significance is the same from 1926 to 1971. And the store and residence also significant at the local level under C as a good example of wood commercial residential building constructed in Hawaii. The commercial storefront and residence reflects a good example of 1920s era construction under criteria C, and 1926 begins the period of significance. The property retains its integrity and so is an excellent example of structures erected purely for business purposes with a rear residence. And that rear residence is always common, either upstairs or behind, for almost all of these buildings along Mamani Street. Okay, thank you.
Okay, any questions from the board for Laura? Laura, can you stop sharing the screen, please?
I can.
Thank you.
Okay. Whoops. Sorry. Okay.
Okay. Any questions for Laura?
Okay, I'd like to commend how thorough she has been and what an interesting story this is. So thank you, Laura.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you, Laura. Great nomination form. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any questions from the audience for Laura? Okay, thanks. Anybody like to make a motion?
Yeah, I'll do it. I move that we put the B, Ikeuchi and Sons Incorporated property on the Hawaii Register for the local significance under criteria A and C, and recommend it's moved on to the National Register.
Thank you, Matt.
I'll second.
Thank you, Alton. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, let's take a vote all in favor of placing this property on the Hawaii Register and move on to the National Register. Okay, looks like unanimous. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Laura. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, next we've moved up the Hawaii Employers Council. Dr. Downer, is everybody here that needs to be for this property?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to state that this property is being nominated to the National Register only, not to the Hawaii Register. Also, there has been an objection to the nomination, which has been filed by the owner of the property. Dr. Downer, would you like to add something to that?
Sure, just for the board's information. The property cannot be listed in the National Register over the objection of the property owner. And the keeper's advice to state review boards, however, is that they should review the nomination, and if they believe that it is eligible, they should vote yes, forward it to the State Historic Preservation Officer. If the SHPO agrees with that, it is to be forwarded to the keeper along with the objection. And the keeper will make, I guess in this case, her evaluation. If she feels it is eligible, it will be placed on a list of places that have been formally determined eligible, but it will not be listed in the National Register.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and with that, I think I'll turn this over to Angie Westfall, who will be doing the presentation.
Thank you, Katie. I'll share my screen here. Okay, can you guys see that?
Yes.
And you can hear me, all right. So this is the Hawaii Employers Council building. This nomination is being put forward by HART as mitigation for the rail project. The Hawaii Employers Council building is a mid-century two-story commercial building built in 1962. It's been the corporate offices of the Hawaii Employers Council since its construction, and a compatible addition was added in 2000. It was designed by Wimberly and Cook Architects. The building is located on Waiwai Loop in the Mapunapuna district of Honolulu, a light industrial area near the Daniel K. Inouye International Airport. At its rear, the building abuts Ke'i Lagoon Park. The building is directly adjacent to the new rail line that will run from the vicinity of the airport towards downtown. A rail station will be located less than a block from the building. Marks the location of the Hawaii Employers Council building on this HART map. And the X shows its neighboring building that has already been demolished to make way for the rail line that's going to go through there. The building extends across the width of its parcel and is set well back from the street. Its overall floor plan, which is a modified chevron shape, is approximately 11,000 square feet. It's two stories high and has a flat roof with a low parapet. The solar panels that you see here are not visible from the ground level, and they also mark the two sections of the building, the original and the addition, with the solar panels being on the original part of the building. The two sections are shown here too, with the original 1962 portion to the north or left of your on this photo, and the addition from 2000 to the south or right of the photo with the parking underneath. The Hawaii Employers Council organization was founded in 1943 in response to the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which guaranteed the rights of workers to organize. The history of labor in Hawaii centers around the plantations. According to Sovereign Sugar Industry and Environment in Hawaii, by the end of the 19th century, Hawaii had transitioned from a Southern Hawaiian nation to an American industrial colony devoted to production of sugarcane and, to a lesser extent, pineapple for the Western U.S. market. And much like the American South, Hawaii has a somewhat notorious history of poor treatment of its plantation workers that dates to the mid-1800s. The Royal Hawaiian Agriculture Society was formed in 1850 to protect plantation interests and to facilitate the importation of cheap labor. That same year, the Masters and Servants Act was passed by the Hawaiian government and was in effect until annexation in 1900. Under this act, said to have been modeled after slave laws in the U.S. South, authorities could charge contract laborers for leaving their employment prior to the end of their contract or for refusing to work. And under the Hawaiian Constitution of 1840, these laborers had no voting rights. Relations between labor and management in Hawaii was contentious long before World War II, when the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, organized the dock workers and was making gains on the sugar and pineapple plantations. The 1946 territory-wide strike took these lessons and capitalized on them. At that time, nearly one-fifth of the population of Hawaii worked on the plantations. It was around that time that the plantation owners founded the Hawaii Employers Council to present a unified front to the ever-increasing unionization of the Hawaii labor force. The founders of the Hawaii Employers Council recognized that with the increased power of local unions, the potential existed for strikes to have crippling effects on Hawaii's local industries. Their purpose was to meet the power of the workers' unions with the power of an organized group of employers. The Employers Council continues to provide much the same services to its members that it did at the time of its founding. Numerous rooms inside the building are set aside for negotiation conferences, and there are management training rooms, resource library, and a section set aside for publication of research and other materials by the council. These are just some examples of some ads that were put out with sort of a back and forth between Hawaii Employers Council and the union. The architecture firm of Wimberly and Cook, which designed the Hawaii Employers Council building, was formed in Hawaii just after World War II. Both men had worked for CPNAB during the war and then opened their firm in Waikiki. From its inception, Wimberly and Cook was intent, Wimberly and Cook's intention was to specialize in hotel and resort design. One of the firm's first commissions was to renovate the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, originally constructed in 1927 in Waikiki. The design of their McInerney store in 1950 was another early Waikiki commission. During the 1950s and 60s, Wimberly and Cook's commissions for commercial properties gained the firm notice for their use of local Hawaiian influences. Their innovative use of materials allowed them to design uniquely shaped buildings, often with tropical antecedents. Other notable projects from Wimberly and Cook were the Canlis Restaurant on Kalakaua, called the world's most beautiful restaurant. Their Waikikian Hotel, with its dramatic roofline, is said to have made hyperbolic paraboloid a household word in Honolulu in the 1950s. The hotel, later referred to as probably Hawaii's most ambitious example of regional style, illustrated the merger of modern and Pacific style architecture. Windward City Shopping Center received national attention for its design. Foodland Supermarket has a thin-shelled curved concrete roof that was the largest concrete shell in the territory, comprised of nearly a half an acre of concrete. The Hawaii Employers Council building was, as I said, was completed in 1962, roughly at the time Wimberly and Cook actually broke up their firm. At this time, Hawaii was still a young state and its architectural design had moved away from territorial styles towards forms that were more contemporary and regional. This building expressed this design direction with the unique glass lack of fenestration on the front facade, replaced with an almost woven texture articulated with CMU on the primary bays. It also had a unique two-story irregularly curved concrete wall that shielded the two-story lobby within. Through the 70s and 80s, the firm now called Wimberly Wizenand Allison and Tong, and with the later addition of Donald Grew, grew its project base beyond Hawaii with contracts throughout the Pacific region, including American Samoa, Fiji, Tahiti, Bora Bora, Singapore, and Malaysia. The firm is now known as WATG and has continued to grow with the construction of luxury hotels and resorts in 119 countries across six continents. According to its website, by 2013, WATG had designed more great hotels and resorts than any other firm on the planet. The firm now has offices in seven international cities and has designed hundreds of destination properties on all the populated continents of the world. The firm has won numerous local, national, international awards for their designs. The Hawaii Employers Council building is a mid-century regional style. It's two-story flat roof commercial building. It's constructed of reinforced concrete and concrete masonry units. It's set back from the street to accommodate parking. The front facade of the building consists of 9 bays, with 3 slightly set back on the right being the 2000 addition. Articulated concrete columns separate a lattice-like concrete facade. A 2-story curving smooth concrete wall marks the main entry and provides a dramatic backdrop for the company logo signage. The wall curving away from the building creates a grand entry on the south side. And on the north side, where it closely hugs the building, there are stacked windows providing additional natural light to the lobby. The 3 southern bays are part of a building addition designed by Philip White Architects, now called White Space Architects, and completed in 2000. The first floor of the addition is a covered parking area, and the second holds offices and conference spaces. The rear of the building also appears as 2 separate sections. You can distinguish the new from the original. And the original portion is divided into 6 bays with columns that are engaged with the first floor level, just as it is in the front. Whereas the rear wall on the second floor is inset, creating a second floor balcony with pipe rails, which looks out over Keihi Lagoon Park and towards downtown Honolulu. The columns at this level are outside the balcony and then tee back under the wide overhang before extending past it. The main lobby of the building is a 2-story space featuring a switchback cantilevered concrete stair with stylistic mid-century railings. The Hawaii Employers Council building is of state significance under criteria A and C. It's significant under A for its association with the history of labor relations in Hawaii. The organization was founded in 1943 in response to the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which guaranteed the rights of workers to organize. The council formed to organize the employers to bring the unions to the table. By February of 1962, when this council moved to its new offices on Waiwai Loop, it had over 300 members. The Employers Council has occupied the building continuously since that time. The building is significant under criteria C for its regional modernist design by the architectural firm of Wimberly and Cook, which had a major influence on Hawaii's architecture in this period. The Hawaii Employers Council building is a notable example of the firm's early small-scale work in Hawaii, characterized by a largely modern but regional design aesthetic. Wimberly and Cook's early work was noted for the use of innovative local styles, materials, and shapes. And while WATG's later work helped usher in the modern day resort era with hotels designed with a Pacific or tropical aesthetic, its early work was much more smaller scale, as demonstrated in this building. The period of significance dates from the construction 1962 through 1970, when the major union legislation was passed and union membership was at an all-time high. The Hawaii Employers Council building retains much of its historic integrity. There have been no significant alterations to the exterior of the original portion of the building. The building retains its original function as well as the original users. The building maintains its integrity of location, materials, and workmanship, feeling, and association. Integrity of design has been somewhat impacted due to the building, addition in 2000. However, the addition is clearly differentiated from the original by a setback and is sympathetic in design and does not distract from the original building's overall appearance, which follows the Secretary of Interior standards. The setting has been somewhat compromised by the surrounding dense development, but the building maintains most of its open grassy area in the front, as well as its original view to Keihi Lagoon Park and Honolulu from the rear of the building. And that is it. Thank you.
Thank you, Angie. Okay, any questions from the board for Angie? Go ahead, Pat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Angie. I do so hope we'll be able to have site visits again in the near future. But I have two issues, and I have a few little quibbles with the history in your narrative statement. But on page 10, the first footnote states that Kaloa Plantation began in 1840, and that's it should read 1835. Okay. It was called Loudon Company at the time, but it's known generally as Kaloa Plantation, and they did their first harvest in 1837. More significantly, I think there's a real misinterpretation about the Masters and Servants Act. It did not look at, it wasn't looking at the South and slavery. And I went back and looked at Wilma Sur's article in the Law Review, and she very specifically says that in 1852, the Constitution promulgated 2 years after the act, it continued to reflect the missionaries' anti-slavery zeal with what would turn out to be the strongest statement against slavery of any iteration of the kingdom's constitution. And I bring that up because it wasn't slavery, and indentured servitude was much more common in the 18th century in America before the revolution. But William Little Lee drafted the Masters and Servants Act in 1850. He was from New York, and he came out with Charles Reed Bishop, and they were anti-slavery folks. And the Masters and Servants Act says there are gonna be two types of labor. One is apprenticeship to learn a trade, and the other is paid by the hour, the day, the week, or some other arrangement. And indentured servitude was quite common. You see, without going on too long, the Central Pacific Railroad in California was bringing in Chinese and had that same indentured servitude kind of approach. And so I would like to see that it's just a phrase, but it's when you say under this act, comma, said to have been modeled after slave laws in the U.S. South, I think that the narrative would be stronger if that is taken out, because I like I said, I think it's a misinterpretation of what the Masters and Slave Act was about. Most of the missionary children who served in the preponderance of them who served in this, who went to fight in the Civil War, fought for the Union, and the missionaries carried through this an anti-slavery sentiment.
I don't argue with you at all, but that's what our research showed. Was that some aspects of the Masters and Servants was modeled on the laws in the South. And I can go back and look at what I didn't write this nomination, but I can go back and look at what you just mentioned and see what it says. But this was, this research was undertaken by our office, and it was also led quite closely by the Hart historian at the time, Stanley Solomillo, who provided us with just a ton of different resources for this. But I'd be happy to give it a second look, and I'm not disagreeing with you that it, because I thought it was a very strong statement myself, but that's what we were told and what we found in our research.
Well, the fourth footnote on that page that references that the phrase credits Wilma Sur's article specifically says, I read to you that it's anti-slavery and not pro-slavery, as the nomination says. So I don't think it's essential to the nomination.
I agree.
Therefore, should come out with, you know, especially seeing the footnote reference that is inaccurate.
Okay. Sure, no problem.
Sounds like you have a baby there.
Yes, my new grandbaby.
I was trying to find out who had the baby.
Yeah, my daughter. That's Margot. She's 5 months old now.
Well, if I can jump in now, I'd echo what Pat said. And yeah, I thought that was an overstatement. I don't know that slave laws were in any sense the inspiration for the master-servant laws of Hawaii. And like I said, they seem quite opposite and progressive in many ways. I think they were just trying to protect the investment of the transport and all. So anyway, I think that's worth looking at. And people do sometimes quote an article that says just the opposite of what it actually, what they're saying it says. I come across that often in dissertations. So,
yeah. And this nomination, more than I think any that we've written to date, was contributed to by Stanley. And I think you all know him, and he has a very, very strong interest in just the ethnic diversity of Hawaii and the what?
Yeah, and labor and all that.
And labor, yes, and all of that. And he has some very strong opinions and a lot of knowledge. So a lot of this was guided by him. So anyway, yes, we can fix it, definitely.
I think it's really important, and the labor aspect is important. But what we're seeing in that period is the beginning of strong anti-Asian laws. And Abraham Lincoln in 1862 signed a law to prohibit any American ships from bringing coolies to the United States from China. And so it is definitely a labor issue, but it doesn't relate to slavery. It relates to servitude.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I will go back to that reference and double check it and take it out. Because I heard, you know, you did read it, so that's fine. And I will make the change to the footnote that said Koloa started in 1935. I don't have a pen, so I can't write it down. It was 1935, not 1940, right?
It was actually 1835. But
1835, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Noted. We will make those changes.
Madam Chair, I have a...
Yes, go ahead, Bill.
Another, it's not a question, but kind of a concern. At some point in your outline, first, I want to compliment the level of work that went into this. So I think it's really interesting, and the building is very interesting, too. And thank you for your presentation, Angie. But you at one point, it says the period of significance is 1960 in your presentation, 1962 to 1970. At another time, when you get to the period of significance on the form, it says the period of significance is 1962 to 2012. And it also talks about significant dates, 2000 being one of them. I would argue that the period of significance is 1962 to 1970. Mm-hmm. And you need to take into account that there was a major addition done in 2000. And the only case you need to make is that doesn't detract from the architect, the character and quality and the,
right,
the original building, but that isn't become significant just by virtue of being attached. And I actually would argue that under review, you know, that on applying the Secretary of the Interior standards, that you have to make a case for that it doesn't detract, because I happen to think it's too imitative. I don't think it would have passed muster. Had it been an investment tax credit project, they would have looked at that and said, it's too imitative. You need to reduce the amount of detail, or you need to do something to easily distinguish it. In fact, it's very indistinguishable from the original. So I think your task is really to make a case that it doesn't detract from the original building, not that it's part of the significance of the building. That's my feeling on it.
Thank you, Bill. Okay, any other questions or comments from the board? Okay, any questions or comments from the audience?
Yes, I have comments, Madam Chair.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Thanks.
My name is Bob Fong. I'm General Counsel for the Hawaii Employers Council. Thank you for the opportunity to offer comments today. I just wanted to note for the record that on February 7th of this year, HEC filed a formal written objection to the nomination. HEC, as the fee owner of the property, respectfully objects to the listing of this property on the historic registers. I agree with Dr. Downer that it's been a long practice that the review board does not list properties over the objections of the private landowner. So accordingly, we just ask that the review board consider that precedent today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, go ahead, Laura.
Yes, I'd just like to know what is the reason why the property owner objects to being listed?
I guess basically we see that being listed would basically a commercial, even though we're a nonprofit, we're basically a commercial operation, and we see that being on the registers or either one of the registers would tie our hands in terms of future development.
No. It doesn't actually. As a private property owner, you still have 100% control over your property. And I mean, maybe Dr. Downer, you can address that being the agency.
Do you want me to respond, Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, sorry, Katie.
No worries. Go ahead, Dr. Downer.
It is true. This is a historic building under state law, as defined by Chapter 6E of the Hawaii Revised Statutes, and so it would be subject to review. If they, doesn't mean that the review would change anything they want to do, but it would nevertheless be reviewed under state law. The listing per se doesn't matter. It's still subject to review because of the definition in the act. Same thing is true if they were to use federal funds to do something to this building. It would still be subject to review under 36 CFR Part 800. Listing or not doesn't really matter in terms of whether or not they'll be, whether or not their project, a proposed project, might be subject to review.
Yes, and thank you. And there's also potential benefits to having your property listed, that you could get tax credits for doing certain things or maintaining your property in a certain way. So there are some benefits as well to being listed. Did you have any questions about any of that, Mr. Fung?
No, we understand all that, and we still maintain our objection. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Okay, if there's no further discussion or questions, would anybody like to make a motion? Oh, I'm sorry, Pat, go ahead.
No, I actually was gonna make a motion for you. I move that we accept this nomination as eligible for the National Register of Historic Places after the two corrections are completed.
Thank you, Pat. Any second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Alton. Okay, any further discussion?
Do we need to specify what the questions are? I think the period of significance is important. I think it needs to be addressed.
Do you want to make an amendment to include that as well?
I would. I think if you don't mind, Pat, I would just go ahead and say to revise the statement about the master and servant law during the period of the kingdom, and also to address the issue of the period of significance to be within the 1962 to 1970.
Incorrect.
And to change any other wording that that reflects or addresses the issue of the addition.
You got, I'll second that. You want us to vote on the amendment and then the regular, or Katie, what, how do you want to deal with that?
Well, I think you can, you've amended now your nomination, and then we can have that reseconded. Someone would like to second your amended nomination. Okay, anybody like to second that for Pat? All right, thank you, Paul. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, we'll have a vote, please, to recognize this as significant and to move this on to the National Register for their review. All in favor? Okay, looks like that's unanimous. Dr. Downer, would you like to make any further statements about process here?
Well, I think that either the next step, once, you know, obviously we'll review the nomination when it's corrected in accordance with the board's desires, and then we will make a determination on whether or not the SHPO concurs with the board's view that it's eligible. If we do, we will forward it to the keeper under the procedures established by the Park Service, along with the letter of objection, and the keeper will do what it does. Make its determination on whether it's eligible or not. And if it is, then they'll put it on the list of formally determined eligible places that the keeper maintains. It will not be, it cannot be as a matter of law, cannot be listed over the owner's objection. So.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Angie.
Thank you. And I'll make those corrections and get it to Shifty's office next week. Thanks. Thank you guys for your comments. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks everybody. Okay, we'll be moving on to the next nomination, which is the Kauai Belt Road. Just wanted to check if anybody needed a quick break. Otherwise, we'll wait until after this nomination review. Well, good. Okay, moving ahead with Kauai Belt Road, which is presented by Guy. I'm not sure if you say Blanchard or Blanchard.
Blanchard, yep.
Okay.
Thanks.
It's all yours. Thank you.
I've heard it every single way, so anything works for me. Right. Is this showing up for everybody?
Yes, we can see that.
Okay, great. So this is probably the most unusual nomination that's coming before you today, but it's an update to the Kauai Belt Road North Shore section, which was listed in the National Register in 2004. The Kauai Belt Road North Shore section is a linear historic district. It extends for approximately 10 miles on Kuhio Highway from milepost 0 in Princeville to milepost 10 at Hyena State Park. The road is a segment of Kauai's historic Belt Road system and is a narrow two-lane road with single-lane bridges and a curvy linear alignment over an undulating landscape along the North Shore. The road has numerous vistas, water crossings, and pull-offs for access and views towards scenic, historic, cultural, community, and agricultural areas, and it is the primary transportation route along the North Shore. Like I said, the district was listed in 2004, listed under criteria A and C and criteria consideration G. The areas of significance identified in that nomination are engineering, social history, transportation, and commerce. The period of significance in that nomination is 1900, when the Territorial Highway Department made improvements to the road through 1957, which was the construction date of the Wainiha bridges. The like I said, the boundary is from mile marker 0 to milepost 10, and it included 15 contributing and 2 non-contributing resources. The historic context that was developed as part of that nomination really documents the Belt Road from the 1800s all the way through 2002 alterations. The current update is a result of the devastating storm and flood event that occurred over the course of several days in Kauai in 2018. There was damage all along the highway caused by flooding, landslides, and debris the governor issued an emergency proclamation on April 15th, which suspended Chapter 6E requirements. However, federal law, like Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, still applied to the emergency repairs. Those repairs included roadway reconstruction, pavement repairs, stabilization, resurfacing, slope scaling, stabilization, debris removal, guardrail replacement, bridge replacements, and bridge rehabilitation. These repairs resulted in a finding of adverse effect on the listed historic district, as well as three contributing and individually NRA eligible properties, the Waipa, Waikoko, and Waioli bridges. To resolve the adverse effect, parties entered into a memorandum of agreement. That was a long process over the summer of 2018. Through that consultation process, there was a decision made to rehabilitate rather than replace Waioli Bridge, which was a victory for historic preservation. The memorandum of agreement was executed in October 2018. And stipulation 5 of that agreement is what outlined the requirement to update the Kauai Belt Road listing. As part of this process, we met with consulting parties in January of 2021 to really kind of understand what they wanted to see as part of an update for this historic property. One of the interesting things that they brought up was that the setting is extremely important to the roadway and the sensory elements along the roadway. These include things like the smell of the agricultural areas as you drive by, as well as the timber planks on the Hanalei Bridge that when you cross it with your car, makes what one individual described as a ka-thunk, ka-thunk sound. So we really felt like this was important to capture in the updated nomination. Another aspect that they brought up was the greater North Shore cultural landscape. Looking at National Park guidance on that, the North Shore is both an ethnographic landscape containing natural and cultural resources that represent the heritage of associated persons, as well as a historic vernacular landscape demonstrating the land's evolution through various uses and the people who shape the land. The Kauai Belt Road is a character-defining feature of that greater cultural landscape. And despite some modern incursions, the Belt Road's narrowness and generally unaltered appearance has had a limiting effect on North Shore development, helping to preserve the cultural landscape that we see today. The historic context for the update really focused on three major things. The first were historic preservation efforts that have occurred along the roadway since the 1970s. The second, obviously, we wanted to update alterations that had occurred since its listing in 2004. And then we wanted to cover the 2018 storm event. So in the mid-1970s, HDOT proposed a two-lane replacement of the Hanalei Bridge at a location approximately 500 feet from the original bridge. And this spurred public outcry and led to the first efforts to recognize the Belt Road and its features as a historic property. The Kauai Historical Society sought NR eligibility determinations for the Hanalei, Waioli, and Waipa bridges and were successful in doing that. A group formed called the North Shore Belt Road Citizens Advisory Committee formed to limit tour buses and, you know, make sure that outsiders were being considerate of the time that they were spending on the North Shore. And then the group shifted efforts toward preservation of the roadway and changed its name to the Hanalei Roads Committee. The Hanalei Roads Committee's advocacy work for the Belt Road resulted in preservation of the Hanalei Bridge and its subsequent rehabilitation and the listing of the Kauai Belt Road in the National Register in 2004, the culmination of a 28-year effort by the Hanalei Roads Committee and local advocacy groups for formal recognition and documentation of the Belt Road. Later, in conjunction with HDOT, a planning document called the Kuhio Highway Route 560 Historic Roadway Corridor Plan was created to guide the design principles of the roadway and included public outreach requirements for any future repairs or maintenance. Instead of going through every single alteration or change that's occurred on the roadway, I've highlighted a few that I think are good examples of the types of changes that we see. This is the Wiley Bridge. On the left is the image from the original nomination. On the right is how it looks today. The Wiley Bridge is one contributing structure within the historic district. It was originally a timber bridge. It was constructed in 1904 and replaced in 1912. It was determined eligible for listing in the National Register in 1978. And in 2019, the bridge was rehabilitated following the Secretary of the Interior standards for the treatment of historic properties by applying a reinforced fiberglass wrap to provide additional strength to the bridge and increase its load limit while preserving its historic concrete and one lane appearance. This is the Waikoko Bridge. The Waikoko Bridge is also a contributing structure within the historic district. The original bridge at this location was built in 1904 and replaced in 1912 with a concrete bridge. And in the image on the left, you can see portions of that concrete bridge right here. On the ends because it collapsed. And in 1946, it was partially repaired. The Waikoko Bridge's design and replacement in 2019 followed consultation with Section 106 consulting parties and adherence to the 2005 Kuhio Highway Historic Roadway Corridor Plan, which balances user safety with historic preservation interests. The result and what we have today on the right is a new bridge that reflects the design considerations of its predecessor and maintains the Kauai Belt Road's location over Waikoko Stream and the feeling and association of the Kauai Belt Road within the North Shore. This is the Waineha Bridge number 2. It's a non-contributing structure within the historic district. It's a single span, single lane, temporary modular acro bridge. The original bridge at this location was constructed in 1922 and then later destroyed and replaced in 1957. The 1957 bridge was replaced in 2004 with this acro bridge. And because the bridge is temporary, we considered it non-contributing to the historic district. So here's sort of a side-by-side comparison of the original nomination and this update. So for this particular update, the roadway continues to be significant under criteria A and C. We've identified a new area of significance, conservation, based on the efforts of the community, the Hanalei Roads Committee, and others to preserve the Belt Road. The period of significance has been extended to 2019 to consider the alterations that have occurred to the roadway. The boundary is unchanged. We have identified 14 contributing and 5 non-contributing resources to the district. The Belt Road retains its integrity of location, design, setting, feeling, and association. And we've updated the historic context to describe these historic preservation efforts, alterations to the Belt Road, and the 2018 storm event. And that is all I've got. So I am happy to entertain any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could unshare. Thank you. Okay, any questions or comments from the board? Yes, Pat.
I just want to congratulate you, Guy. So often we don't hear about the community response, and Hanalei Roads Committee has had, through thick and thin, has worked successfully with the preservation efforts. And it is really, it is such an important part of that history, and you did a great job of condensing it and contextualizing the process with that inclusion.
Great, thanks.
Madam Chair, I'd want to congratulate you too. I think it's a very thorough, very interesting. It's clear that you've had significant experience as an architectural historian. I still have problems with end dates on periods of significance. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily alter what you've said, but it seems that your charge is to basically assess whether the alterations or rehabilitation of properties has been too so extensive as to threaten the original listing, I think, in many ways. So it seems that anything that's taken place in this century would not in itself be within a period of significance, as you suggest. So my thought is the period of significance could perhaps be stretched to as late as 1972, with the 50-year cutoff when the beginnings of the preservation effort began. And then from then on, your task is to basically argue that these changes that took place in 2019 did not threaten the original listing. That's my read on it. That's how I would call it. I know these are complicated, but we've had a history of not having anything, any significant feature or building past the period of significance be in itself historically significant. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's something we struggled with, I think, with this, because we did want to capture that historic preservation movement that occurred on the North Shore. And really, the date when that started was about 1974. So as we were putting this together, that was, we just felt like such an integral part of the story of the Belt Road that we wanted to tell that story and put that information in here. And I'm not sure if it makes you feel any better, but we did run this by HDOT, and their cultural resources specialist was okay with this. And I know they're the ones that are going to have to be dealing at least with these potentially contributing structures, these new bridges, and treating them as contributing resources to the historic district.
But as I said, by having the end date be 2019, basically anything built up to that period is already historic within 3 years.
Yeah, it's also my understanding that the period of significance can't extend any closer than 50 years from now. So okay. It would need to be cut off in 1972, which would mean then I don't know that you could include the significance of that preservation effort as one of the reasons, but I do think it should be included in the information. I mean, it's very important to the property, but I just don't know if you could include it as one of the reasons for the significance.
That's what I would think too.
I mean, properties less than 50 years of age are listed in the National Register all the time, right? So that's, you know, the 50-year cutoff is something that is, you know, it can be worked around. And in National Register Bulletin 15, it discusses historic districts, and if a majority of resources are greater than 50 years of age, then you don't need to address criteria consideration G. So we did not for this right. For this particular property.
But on the other hand, you're basically listing properties that are just over the line or something. In this case, you're actually saying that something 3 years ago is still in itself significant, which I think basically was a repair to a property originally deemed significant for the period of what, 19, what was it?
Through 1957, yeah.
So I would stand strongly on this. So we've had stuff sent back to us because of this open-ended kind of idea. And I mean, everybody does do interpretations, but my read on this is then that alteration to the Waikoko Bridge is itself already significant within 3 years of its construction.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, please, go ahead, Dr.
I mean, so the Park Service, you know, guidance does say that for properties that are in continuing use, that it doesn't have, the period of significance doesn't have to end at 50 years ago. But the reality is, I think, as Bill describes it, that you know, you've got to make a really powerful case for it. Otherwise, I mean, the Park Service sounds like they're more flexible than I think they are in practice.
There's very specific guidance on when you can go over the date. I mean, something extraordinarily significant, but still it can't be, we can't say that World Trade One is already significant. I mean, just because we know it will be significant I mean, really, there has to be a certain passage of time, like with the Kennedy Space Center and places like that, or even back in the day with Seagram Building. I think it was only 35 years old when it got listed, but it wasn't 2 years old when it got listed.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, Laura, actually, would you like to say something?
I just have a question on the Waikoko Bridge. Why didn't the people under historic discussion decide to, if they can't replace it with native bluestone, why not do a facing of the concrete that way rather than having a solid concrete bridge?
I think the intent with the solid concrete was to replicate the appearance of the original concrete bridge that was there, because the stone that was there was sort of, I don't know, kind of an ad hoc measure to get a bridge functional again, and it sort of stuck around. I mean, that collapsed bridge was there for a really long time. But that's a great question for HDOT.
From the evidence that you provided, I would think that rehabilitation of that bridge would have made it a no longer contributing property, but that may be not complete. I mean, what we saw was a concrete replacement of a building with stone piers on either side. I mean, a structure with stone piers on either side, but I kind of saw in the distance there was a concrete part of the bridge. So that was, I'd have to know more to be able to figure that out. But.
Okay, any other comments or questions for Guy? Okay, anybody like to make a motion?
I guess I would like to make a motion, Madam Chair. And
thank you, Bill.
I move that the bridges of the North Shore of Kauai be submitted to the National Register with our recommendation for listing under criteria A and C, with the stipulation that the period of significance be limited to no later than 1972.
Thank you, Bill. Any second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Pat. Okay, any further discussion?
Clarification. Yes. So this would mean the bridges that fall outside that period and other changes would be non-contributing to the roadway?
You're on mute, Bill.
Mute.
Bill, you're on mute.
I think we'd have to see some as basically repair and maintenance of a normal sort, and others as possibly threatening the continued listing. But I don't know that I know enough about that latter part. So I'm kind of taking your word for it, but I don't think we could consider the repairs themselves significant.
So would he then need to amend his nomination to remove those items as being contributing?
I would think so.
Okay. So would you like to amend the your nomination, your
all right, and
motion?
And thereby amend the document to reflect that change of date.
Okay, somebody like to second Bill's amended motion?
Seconded.
Thank you, Matt. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, we'll take a vote then.
Can you repeat the motion, please?
Bill, can you repeat that?
I was thinking the recorder would repeat it. I move that the board recommend the renomination of the North Shore Kauai Road to the National Register for Historic Places, with as amended, but to reflect a time period from, I'm sorry, Guy, what's the time period again? 19.
Oh, I have one more question. Sorry.
Well, tell me the time period quick and we'll get the motion and we can go back.
Yeah, to it. Sorry. So the area of significance that we've added or identified is conservation, which really takes place after the 1972 cutoff. How would you like me to address that in this edit?
Well, I think there is probably some wiggle room. If you can say the organization began in 1974, I think that's allowable to have slightly over the period of significance. So perhaps we could bring it to 1974 in order to incorporate that significant event. That would be my thought. And then you could include that information as an aspect of the history, because it obviously stopped the rebuilding of all these bridges and the widening of the bridges and things like that. So I agree with you, that's significant. It's just relatively recent, but not as recent as 2019.
Okay.
Is that possible?
We'll see.
It's a lot to think about.
Yeah. I feel like so much of that was really a product of that first Hanalei Bridge, you know, demolition and replacement plan. And everything is sort of a result from that moment. And that was 1974, 1975. So really anything that deals with historic preservation and the Belt Road occurred after that time. So within the 50 year period. So I just want to make sure that if we are.
Well, I mean, I would be, you know, if I were sitting on your committee throwing ideas around.
Yeah.
I would try to find some. Could you in the 1970s find some significant time once the initial move had been made? Or when was the original listing, for instance?
For the Belt Road?
Yeah.
2004.
Ooh.
Well, when
was the main thrust of the momentum to preserve it? When was that period?
Well, I mean, like I was saying, the fight sort of was brewing 1974, 1975. In 1978 was when the local historical society pushed for individual NR eligibility determinations for a few of the bridges. And then there was another.
My recommendation would be to take it to that period, to as late as 1980 even. But like I said, it's very something 40 years old, you can argue as a historic event. Something 2 years old is hard to argue as an historic event. That's all.
I mean, if the keeper kicks it back to you, I mean, is that what you're worried about? I mean, if that happens, what's...
Well, it's our own consistency and frankly, consistency of understanding and precedent and things like that.
I understand.
About where it would be really embarrassing, you know? And you got to remember, a board like this actually does get weird listings like that. I mean, sure. I've done nominations all over the country too. I had a board one time that wanted to list the stones that were used in a well from a building they demolished as a historic site. I mean, and it was about 3 years old, but they thought that was significant. I tried to argue that the well could be significant in another 50 years, but it wasn't significant already. And so, I mean, we want to kind of protect from that in a way in the future. We don't want to have someone do a building and then immediately say, we feel this is significant, right?
I think Dr. Downer, you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to observe in terms of the process, if for example, the keeper disagrees with the period of significance and sends it back, we just amend the nomination to reflect the period of significance. And in point of fact, the keeper may well just simply list it with a supplemental listing sheet saying, we're listing it, but the period of significance is this rather than what's on the nomination.
But Alan, that does set a bad precedent for us. You know how many houses we get that they say it was built in 1926 and they finally got another addition in 2005 and they want to push, do we want to then say that the significance goes up to 2005 for that property?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing for all the way to 2005.
Or 2019.
Yeah, in point of fact, I'm not arguing either way. I'm just giving you information. I mean, I guess this is one I'm thankful I'm not on the board, because I kind of sit on the fence. I mean, I think the historic property is the Belt Road itself. And I do think when you're talking about, what is essentially a transportation corridor, that, you know, that's going to change over time. The road's going to shift a little bit. You know, is it no longer a historic road when it gets resurfaced? I think it still is a historic road. So, I mean, I see it both ways, and I certainly understand your argument. And, I'm not arguing one way or the other. I agree. I think it's a bad idea to extend the period of significance, maybe even as late as 1980. But certainly if you get past 1980, I think it's coming back.
So I would be willing to amend it to say, if you think you will be able to incorporate all that very excellent research, and I do think it's interesting now, we're seeing a couple of projects where we get the preservation itself is becoming significant. I think it is an interesting issue. But I think you also understand our reasoning for why we couldn't say 2019 is the end date, because that actually would set them up for all sorts of problems if they want to alter a rehabilitated bridge that are now subject to a built that element is now significant historically as well.
Yeah, and that's why, we passed this along to HDOT's cultural resources staff to review first to make sure that they were okay with this approach. But I understand.
They were just busy.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I said, let's just hope they were busy. And
yeah, right.
Because that would really upset so many of the decisions we made.
So I'm wondering if actually you want to revise this and maybe it should be reviewed by HDOT again before you send it in. Perhaps we should defer this and allow Guy to make those changes and resubmit it. Guy, do you think you would need to have HDOT review this if you change those items?
I'm not sure. We're getting to things that are out of scope for what I was charged to do as part of HDOT's work on the Belt Road. So I'm trying to minimize revisions as much as possible. I'm happy to obviously make changes and kick it back to HDOT for review. But I want to keep those as minimal as possible. Sure. If it's simply going through and just switching the period of significance, changing those to non-contributing, I'm fine to do that and just leave the conservation, historic preservation discussion in there as is. I think it's awkward to maybe not address it head on, that it doesn't fall within the period of significance. But, if we can find a compromise date, perhaps 1978 is a compromise date, because that's when some of those bridges were first individually determined eligible. Perhaps that's where we go.
So let me amend my.
Okay.
Sorry. Let me check Bill first. Guy, are you comfortable with making those revisions and then just giving it to Shifty for them to forward on to National Park Service?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think that's fine. Yep.
All right, go ahead, Bill Chauvin.
Okay, so I move that we recommend the listing of the amended nomination for the North Shore Bridges and Highway, under criteria A and C, and that the period of significance be all changed to, what was the original one, 19? What was the original beginning date?
I'm going to say 1978, I think, makes the most sense to me.
No,
if you guys are okay with that.
What was
1900.
From 1900 to 1980, and 1978 to reflect the changing history of the site. And that changes to the record of contributing and non-contributing be altered to reflect that change in date.
Thank you, Bill. Go ahead, Pat.
I was going to second that.
Oh, great. Thank you, Pat. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor of Bill Chapman's motion? Okay. Looks like unanimous. All right. Thank you, Guy.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Guy is excellent. It was really a pleasure to read, and your a stellar professional. So thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate the read.
And Chandra, can you be sure that you send us a copy of the this revised nomination as well as the one for, not Hawaii Employers Council, they were going to revise that, but yes, Hawaii Employers Council. So nominations that were going to be changed, if you could just send us a copy of the revised version so that we have that for our record, we'd appreciate that.
Yes, I can do that.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you. Our next nomination is the Howe Beach Cottage. I'd like to propose that we just have a quick 5-minute break. Everybody can get a glass of water and all that, and we'll be back in 5 minutes. So once we see that we have Don Hibbard and Bill Chapman back, we can move ahead.
I'm here.
Thanks, Don. We'll give Bill Chapman another 30 seconds.
Oh, they eat enough. Floating island.
Okay, why don't we just go ahead and get started? Bill's got the name and nomination form, and you can jump in. Go ahead, Don.
Okay. The house we'll be looking at first is the Luther Ho House, or Howe. Starting over. Wrong one. Yeah. Sorry, I'll be with you in a second. Having problems loading. Yes. Mm-hmm. Ah, that's my mistake. Okay, sorry. Right. And here. And okay. Then. Okay, got it together. Sorry. Okay, this is the Lutheran ADHO Howe Beach Cottage, which is at 68433 Crozier Drive. You may recall two or three meetings ago, we registered another beach cottage out in Mokulea. This house is right next door to it. I have to make a correction to the form. I screwed up and put 1924 as a significant date, but the significant statement says 1926, and it is 1926. The front lanai was added in 1946 after the tsunami. The architect is unknown. Essentially, it's a vernacular house. The Howe Beach Cottage is significant on the local level under Criterion C as a good example of a beach cottage built in Honolulu during the mid-1920s. The house is also significant. Under Criterion A for its associations with the development of the Mokulea Beach Lot subdivision. Here's what the house looks like from the street from Crozier Drive. Essentially, you have a single car garage here and the house back here. And the single car garage has been resided on this side with T111. Originally it was a carport, but the rest remains intact. Primarily the house faces towards the ocean. Here's the back of the garage. The garage has a little storage room here and a laundry room here. The house, the original house was this hip roof house, cottage, and then they added this shed roofed lanai in 1946 because the tsunami took the house off its foundations, which was post and pier, and moved it. So they thought a lanai on a solid concrete foundation will help stabilize the house and keep it in place against other high waters. The front lanai has double doors, French doors, and to each side are a set of sliding windows, each with three horizontal panes, which would be typical of the 30s and immediate post-war period. Inside, the double doors open onto a lanai area, which is obviously enclosed, sliding windows on all sides. The floor is scored concrete. And the ceiling is new. They put boards up on the ceiling new. So that's one of the few changes that's been made to this house. Here is the line for the original cottage. They took out part of the wall. So you have sort of an interaction with the lanai. There's one concrete step leading up to the living room area. The living room is the whole house is fairly modest. Here you can see the bookcases they built in here, and you can see the relationship of the living room to the lanai. The living room does have an original fixture as well as Kleenex ceilings. Kleenex ceilings is found throughout the house. The floor is fir, which is again original as well. Here's the living room looking Malka. There's three doors. This one leads into a bedroom. This one leads into the bathroom. And this one leads into the kitchen. Very simple house, tongue and groove walls. simple framing, and there's another bedroom off here with a door here. That door is a pocket door, single panel pocket door. And then this room has one over one, double hung windows, single wall again. It also has a light fixture as in the living room. The second bedroom is being used as an office. And again, it has a light similar to the other two. Again, the original floor is Kleenex ceiling. A five panel door, which would be a little retro for the 1920s. So I suspect it was probably reused from somewhere else. Has an internal interior girt and has sliding windows, which you see use the girt as well as a picture rail to frame the window and allow it to function. These are two pane windows. The bathroom is in the middle. It also has a five panel door, linoleum floor. You can see it goes through. You have your toilet and sink over here. A shower is here. And then there's an addition that was built on the back in the 2000s, which is essentially a sitting changing area. You can see here. You can see it's not framed out. It's very obviously a new addition, although on the outside, it reads like part of the building. It has new windows also, but very minor addition overall. Here's the kitchen. The kitchen has its original shelving and cabinetry, original porcelain sink, original windows. Here's a side door that goes out towards the garage side of the house. And again, you can see more of the original shelving, the Kleenex ceiling, linoleum floor. Here's the door that leads out, which has a slider to secure it. I found this interesting. I haven't seen one of these ever. It's essentially where you can make orange juice and it's onto the, it's attached to the wall. The backyard is open. There's a kamani tree in the back. Now paka separates the property from the ocean. And then here's the beachfront on the house. I'm nominating the house to the Hawaii Register at the local level under criterion C as a good example of a beach cottage built in Honolulu during the mid 1920s. I guess I should say Oahu, not Honolulu. And under criterion A for its associations with the development of the Mokulea Beach Lots subdivision. I think the house is a good example of a beach cottage. A very modest one. It's single wall. The living room, lanai, open living area shows the informality and part of the beach situation, as well as the small bedrooms, which of course the house is small, but again, it's showing that it's not permanent residency, but more for beach, although now it's permanent residency. There's around a dozen beach houses listed on the register to date. A good number of them are in Lanikai. Out here in Mokulea, the next door neighbor house, which is also a very much a vernacular residence. Then also down the road is the Mendonca residence, which Ray Morris designed. But a lot of the ones in Lanikai also are architect designed houses. So I think this is a good example of a vernacular home again. And I think it's an example of the opposite of what Laura was making yesterday, saying that modest houses and owners of modest houses without money can't get them registered. This person that owns this house does not have money. And essentially she's very attracted to getting some tax relief as a result. But so she sees the benefit that way. And again, this home has been in the family since the 1980s. So she's very much concerned that way. Originally, the Mokalia beach lots were subdivided in 1924. It was a 17.78 acre parcel that was subdivided by Crozier, and Crozier Drive now holds his name. And in 1924, this lot was sold to Joshua and Marion Pratt. I cannot find any evidence that they built the house on the lot, but in 1926, they sold the lot to Luther Ho and his wife. I suspect they built the house because there was a fairly substantial mortgage they took out with Crozier at that time, which was more than what I think the value of the lot was worth. So I'm quite sure they probably built the house in 1926. And I found a nice little reference in the newspaper in 1927 saying that their son saw the airplane coming into Wheeler Field. That was the first Trans-Pacific flight. And he got up 6 in the morning, and they mentioned that he was living for the summer out in Mokalea. That after he saw the plane, he ran home and told his mother immediately. So I'm pretty sure that they're in residence in 1925, and I believe they probably built, or rather 1927, and they built the house in 26. Mr. Ho was a cashier for Hawaiian Pineapple Company. They lived in Makiki and that used this totally as a summer house and weekend residence. He was very much into water sports and stuff. He was a swimming coach at Central YMCA, and he was also the boatswain for the Myrtle Boat Club. And so I think it's associated, I suspect, with his love of the water. That's probably why they motivated to get the beach house to begin with. In 1933, Mrs. Ho dies at the age of 46. She was a native of Wailuku, Maui originally. Mr. Howe originally also was a native of Honolulu, born in 1893 and graduate from McKinley High School. After his wife dies, 7 months later, he sells this beach house, and it's gone through several owners since then. But like I said, since the 1980s, the present family has owned the house. So that's all I have to say. It's a very intact home, except for the little addition of the to the shower, which I'll show you again. Boom, boom. Which you can see here, this little shed roofed area. That's the shower addition that was built. And I think it's very minor compared to the overall integrity of the house. And I don't think it compromises the character of the house either. So I'd appreciate if you would register this at the local level under criterion C for its architecture as a good example of a vernacular beach house. And also under criterion A for its associations with community planning, the development of the Mokalea beach lots. With that, I'll get out of sharing.
Thank you, Don. Okay, questions from the board for Don. Go ahead, Pat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just a small housekeeping piece. I noticed on photo 4 that the name of the property is listed as the William and Mabel Dyer Beach House.
Oh, sorry about that.
You might want to change that.
Yes, thank you. Number 4?
Yes.
Okay, I'll change that as well as the date on the significance and the period of significance.
And the bungalow. You mentioned that it shouldn't say bungalow, it should say beach house.
Yes. I think, does the significance say bungalow also? Right. Okay, I'll double check that.
It was just on the what you shared us.
Oh yeah, that would be on the screen. I think I screwed up when I was doing the PowerPoint.
Okay, other questions or comments from the board?
Just curious a little bit, Don. So is it Ho or How?
I don't know. They're dead.
You said it two different ways. You never said Huff, which is another possibility, I guess.
Okay.
So there's no house around anymore, huh?
I didn't look, to tell you the truth.
Doesn't matter for the writing, I'm sure. Yes. It was nice to see a Norton stoneware jug in one of the pictures. I have an identical one in my house. You might recognize that from Northern New York State, Vermont, Bennington, Vermont, around 1840s, 1850s. That was interesting. See, that's, I just wanted to point out that were we to go with what we were looking at for the bridges, we would have to list that little addition as part of the significance of the property and consider that historic. I mean, if we were going to follow through logically, which is why I gave him such a hard time last time because of that. So before I leave, though, I did forget something from yesterday, Don. The heading on all of the one for the Richards house has a typo.
Oh.
It, instead of saying Montague, it says M-G-N-A-T-A-G-U.
Oh, okay. The heading on that one?
All each page. I forgot to mention it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions from the board? Okay. Any comments or questions from the audience? Okay. Would anybody like to make a motion?
Sure, I'll make it. I move that we list the Hoh residence on the Hawaii Register of Historic Places under criteria A and C. And Don, you want to move it up to the National Register as well?
You can.
Okay, and recommend we forward it to the National Register for consideration as well.
Thank you, Matt. Any second?
I'll second.
Thank you, Paul. Any further discussion? Okay, take a vote, please, on the motion made by Matt. It's like all in favor.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations, Don. Thank you.
Okay, I also have the next nomination, which is the Holzinger residence, which is in Waikiki at the end of Kapi'olani Park and the Diamond Head Terrace. Let me see if I can get this quickly. Okay, this is another fairly modest home. It's a Donald and Lillian Holzinger residence. It's located at 2823 Coconut Avenue. I said at the end of Kapi'olani Park, the Diamond Head Terrace track. It was just like the last beach house was also built in 1926. And just like the beach house, I don't know the architect as newspapers did not report it. Although I know the builder was the Pacific Trust Company who at that time was managing the Diamond Head Terrace subdivision sales. The Holzinger residence is significant at the local level under criterion C is a good example of a bungalow this time, built in Hawaii during the mid-20s. The house is also significant on the local level under criterion A for its associations with the development of Diamond Head Terrace. This is the house from the street. It has a new fence in front. Tahitian gardenia plants are in the front, screening the fence. The house has essentially a lateral running gable roof with an intersecting front facing gable projects slightly from the house. The lanai dominates most of the facade. A walk comes up from the gate to a little concrete pad, which I imagine was originally, and there's also another stepping stone walk that runs from the driveway. Has its original lava rock shoulders with concrete caps on top. Original rectangular columns on the lanai, and also a rather interesting balustrade in that it has this, the house has horizontal lap siding, but it has this little indent here, which I've never seen before. And it's on the front.
Well, you can see it here on the front again. And I'll show you. Now this hard. I think I have another picture of it. And it's also on the rear. So both sides indent in the center. I can only figure it out to be a decorative feature, but rather interesting little tidbit, which would have taken a little extra work to create. As you can see, here's the rectangular columns. The floor has been replaced on the lanai. The rest of the interior of the house, the floors are original. The house has louvered doors for screens and has all its double hung windows, 6/1. The double hung windows have their original hardware, the handles to pull up, and also the locks. Here you can see the 15 light double doors that were original to the house. And you can see the living room. The living room ceiling's been replaced, but the rest of the house has its original ceiling. The fir floors are all original. The living room flows through where I'm standing, is back here, and goes through to another set of double doors, this time with side lights, which lead to a rear lanai. So there's total cross ventilation going across the living room space. The kitchen wall has been removed, which a lot of people do. I don't find it too jarring with the new remodeled kitchen, although the original windows remain in the kitchen as well. The back lanai has been replaced. Again, it was deteriorated and beyond salvage, so they stuck a new one on, but it's the same footprint. They had to replace the wood step there as well. But again, this is on the back of the house, and I don't think it detracts from the character of the house. Here you can see the lateral running gable roof very well. You have a small little hip wing here for the kitchen. You'll be happy, Bill, you probably can't read it from this picture, but it is a wood shingle roof, which they did keep when they re-roofed it. Oh, I'm sorry, where did I go? Go back. Also on the property, this was a garage. You can see it's board and batten, and it's listed as a non-contributing property because all the windows have been changed and they've made it into a small studio. So it's on the property, but it's non-contributing as the whole interior has also been modernized. The kitchen, the living room runs across the whole front of the house. Here you can see three double hungs on this side as well as a double hung on this side. Here's the kitchen over here. And the house also keeps its original baseboard, which I was surprised how high it was for 1926. And also they have a wainscot, a girt which serves as a wainscot. There's an opening without a door in the Malka wall, which leads to the bedroom wing, and which has a small front to rear hallway. This is the linen closet. All the doors are single panel. They all keep their original hardware and knobs. Here you can see that door, the closet door. Here's the doorway leading to the rear bedroom. Again, you can see the girt single TNG walls. Here is the back bedroom, nicely ventilated with 6/1 double hungs on two walls, the original ceiling. It has its closet with the original glass knob. Also, it has a beveled mirror in the closet door. Here you get a close-up of the glass knobs that are being used. The bathroom has been remodeled, although it retains its TNG walls, retains its door. And down the hall is the second bedroom with the front bedroom. And again, it has a beveled mirror on the closet and double hung windows to ventilate the room. So a very modest house, a very simple house. As I said, the Pacific Trust Company, to try and encourage acquisition of lots, built the house, and then the Holzingers purchased the house the day it was put on the market. As for the Holzingers and Diamond Head Terrace, Diamond Head Terrace was originally subdivided in 1921. And although it said it was the cheapest subdivision in Waikiki, sales moved very slowly, surprisingly enough. And in 1924, 3 years later, only a third of the properties had sold. 25 of the 73 lots had been sold. In 1924, Waterhouse Trust, which had subdivided the property, sold the whole property to the Pacific Trust Company. And so they took assumed the management and sale of the property from then on. They reduced prices somewhat. And also in 1926, they started to build houses on the lots and sell them or to prospective owners. Holzingers bought this house in 26. Mr. Holzinger had a job I never thought about before, but his company was the Hawaii Barber Supply. And he supplied all the barbers in town with their necessary ingredients and razors and things like that. The Depression was not good to him. And in 1932, the house reverted back to the Pacific Trust Company because it was foreclosed on. And then it was resold after that. Right now, there's 23 houses in Diamond Head Terrace on the register already. So this make this the 24th house. So we're reaching the one-third mark on registered houses in the subdivision. And probably at some point, I probably should do a multiple property nomination for it, but I have been too lazy up to date to do that. So again, I think it's significant under criterion A for its associating with Diamond Head Terrace. I think also it's a good example of a bungalow built in Hawaii during the mid 20s, a very modest bungalow, but it has the bungalow features with the front facing gable, the open floor plan, the post and pier, the overhanging eaves. So that way, and just the little small detail on the front porch that just separates it a little bit. To date, I counted I couldn't believe it, but I recounted it. We only have 7 bungalows from the 1920s listed on the register that were in Honolulu. So there's not very many to date, although it was a very common building style. So that's the nomination. We're nominating at the local level under criterion C for its architecture as a good example of a bungalow, and under criterion A for its associations with the development of Diamond Head Terrace. And again, the only changes have been the reflooring of the front lanai, the new ceiling put in the living room, the kitchen opened up, and then replacement of the back lanai with a new back lanai. Otherwise, the house is very much intact and some modification to the bathroom.
Thank you, Don.
I'll get out a screen share.
Okay, questions or comments for Don from the board? Okay, any from the audience? Oh, go ahead, Bill.
Warren, thanks, Madam Chair. I think it's a really interesting property. I remember when they were working on it. Do you know, it went through major rehab or restoration about 4 or 5 years ago, is that correct?
That's what I was told, yes.
I remember watching it. It was in terrible condition. It's really something. And you're right. I love the wood roof. I wish this really brings the quality of the building up to what I think is really worth recognizing and hope it kind of brings other properties to that right level of recognition too. It's interesting. I agree that it's a bungalow. It's also what I think they often call a gable L cottage because of the fact of the prominent cross gable in the front.
Right.
That's called a full return, by the way, if you want to get incorporate that.
Okay, yes, as opposed to a broken
pediment. Return. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a neat thing. I thought it was curious that they painted the windows the same color on the inside as the outside. That was an odd choice to have the black interior windows. Are they wood windows, in fact?
Yes, they are. They're the original windows.
So it wasn't like they had to have them pre-painted or something, and that's why it ended up that way.
No, I think it was an individual choice.
Yeah, I had a house with green windows like that, but the inside was, of course, white to match the woodwork. It's just interesting. So it's a terrific little property, I think. So.
Yeah, I've actually seen this property before, and I know that the owners made a real effort in their repair work to really replace in kind and make everything match all the original trim and everything inside. So it was, I think, a really good repair restoration project.
Yeah, nice, modest $2 to $3 million bungalow.
Yeah. Hard to imagine it was hard to sell properties in that location one time. Okay, any other questions for Don? Okay, anybody like to make a motion? Paul, he's got his hand raised.
I move that we recommend that Donald and Lillian Holsinger residents to the State Historic Register under criteria A and C. Do you want it to the national recommended to? Or
I do so.
And recommend that it be added to the National Register.
Thank you, Paul. Okay, second? Pat seconds. Great. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, we'll take a vote, please, for Paul's motion. Great, unanimous. Thank you, Don.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, looks like rest of our agenda here, meeting dates, May 20th, we have already, yesterday's meeting, voted to have limited meeting on May 19th. I know, Pat, you weren't here, but at this point, they're looking like we were going to do in-person meetings for May and April, or sorry, May, the May date. Of course, we'll see what happens between now and then, but keeping our fingers crossed that that can happen and we can have the site visits again. There's the list here of those that are submitted for the May meeting. There will be one in addition, which is the property that Don previously submitted that we deferred because there was an addition that was being constructed at that time in the back, and we wanted to see how that turned out. So that will also be on our list.
Katie, I have one more addition. It's going to be the Queen's Quarters, and we are going to be taking off Hawaii Yacht Club.
Okay.
Trading, so we'll have a total of 8 nominations for the next meeting.
Okay, thanks. Just curious, where is the Queen's Quarters?
Queen's Quarters is Alapai Street, Alapai Apartment. So it's 1308 Alapai Street.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that looks like that's it for our agenda. Any other comments or questions? Dr. Downer, anything?
Well, I have a couple things. One is that I want to say thank you for circulating all the information you had on Bill Sousa's passing and his funeral. You know, just as an observation, which I chose not to share by email, but you know, every time I ran across Bill, he reminded me so much of my godfather. I literally did a double take. He looked like him, he acted like him, he sounded like him, he told stories the same way, and you know, and if George hadn't been dead for 50 years, I would have said, you know, well, maybe he's been hanging out with John Kennedy, I don't know. Anyway, But I really miss the guy, even though, it's been a year or so since he was on the board. He's a loss to all of us. So I just wanted to say that. Also, I would like, if people are willing, I'd like to take about 5 minutes to update you on what's happening in the legislature, because we have had an exciting session so far. So right now, there's still a little bit of time for bills to cross over and stay alive in this session, but a number of bills that we have been dealing with have died or are almost certainly dead, although there's still, like I say, there's some time left. So HB 2135 and its companion bill, Senate Bill 3103, which would delegate 6E, 8 reviews to DHHL on DHHL land. That is moving forward, and I kind of think that's almost certain to pass. The opposition to it has been very minor. And I think it's, unless something dramatic happens, I don't see it getting derailed. HB 2167 and SB 3135, which would have delegated 6E42 reviews to the counties. The Senate version did cross over, but it is dead in the House. The Water and Land Committee deferred it without another hearing date. So I think that's dead. It's dead. The Senate version is dead. The House version is dead. So I think that's not going anywhere this year. No bill is dead until they adjourn, but I think the odds are very much against those bills being revived. SB 570, which would change the current definition of historic property in the Act, right now, to be defined as a historic property, something has to be 50 years old. This would add in requirement that it be also eligible for the Hawaii Register. So far, that's much to my surprise, that seems to be moving forward. Every time we've tried to amend the definition of historic property in the past, because I think, frankly, 50 years alone is a nonsense definition, but every other year we've tried to get a definition change, has just died. In some years couldn't even get its first hearing. That actually looks to be moving forward. It has crossed over. The Water and Land Committee in the House passed it, so it's on to Judiciary and Hawaiian Affairs, and then it goes to the Finance Committee as the last one before it goes to a House vote. So it has passed through the process completely unamended at this point. Watch this space. We'll see what happens.
I think Don has a quick comment, maybe.
Yeah. You're muted.
You're still muted.
Don, you're muted.
Don, we can't hear you. You gotta unmute.
Sorry. I was responsible for changing that definition to 50 years. And the reason that was done, it was back in the 80s. Harold Matsumoto at that time was at the University of Hawaii, and they stopped sending us things because they said, well, we don't know if it's eligible or not, so we're not sending you. So I changed it to 50 years. I say, you know how old the building is, so now you can send us the reviews. So that was the reason we did that. But maybe now state agencies are more cooperative, and the new nomination, the new definition will work. But that was the reason I did that, was because they were claiming total ignorance that we don't know and we're not going to send it to you if we don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least they have been pretty good about actually inventorying the entire campus. So, they ought to know now. But, the fact of the matter is that the permitting agencies, for the most part, mm-hmm. It's catch as catch can. Sometimes they send us stuff, sometimes they don't. some, you know, they send us as many things that they shouldn't be sending us as, you know, as they don't, you know, as things that they should send us don't get sent. And yeah, I mean, that's an enormous problem. And until the counties are willing to say, yes, we're going to staff up so that we can make, you know, that sort of first wave of decisions internally before we, you know, turn people loose, either to not go to SHPD or to send it to SHPD, I think there's going to be a problem. And that's true even with the 50-year, 50-year standard is the sole definition. The last bill besides the budget is SB 1411, which creates a new category of historic property. It defines the new category as pre-contact historic properties, so those properties that existed when Cook first arrived. The principal purpose of this change is to increase the penalty for damage to a pre-contact site. It raises it to $30,000 per violation. And overall raises the violation level from 10 to 20,000 for all historic properties. So, there are parts of that that we support quite strongly within the department. The problem with creating this category is that unless we can show it's in Cook's journal, it's very difficult to say categorically, yes, this place was here before Cook arrived. Archaeology just doesn't work that way. So far I haven't been able to convince anybody in the legislature that matters. So at this point, all signs are that it's going to pass.
What about Japanese and Spanish contact, Alan?
Well, so it's the specific date is the date of Cook's arrival. The date that's in this, in the amendment to the statute. So, I mean, yes, there's all sorts of, all sorts of problems with this if you get into the details, but they have chosen Cook's arrival as the date for the definition. And I think if you read Cook's journals, it's pretty clear that Hawaiians had encountered iron before Cook arrived. So there were other contacts, but, that we don't have any journals to document that anyway. So the last one is the budget. And I have to tell you, when the Finance Committee heard the budget last week and they announced their action, I almost literally fell out of my chair. So the governor recommended adding 14 positions to SHPD. The Finance Committee agreed to 14. New positions. In addition, they added a significant amount of money to our budget to increase wages for the technical professionals so that they are more competitive with the private sector. They gave us 88% of the requested increase in wages. When we put this budget together, way back in September, I sat down and said, I'm going to ask this year for the first time, I'm going to ask for what I think we need. And I sent it up to the chair and expected it to be cut. She didn't touch it, sent it on to the governor. I expected the governor and the budget and finance office to cut it. They didn't touch it. So they went to the finance committee with all of SHPD's ask in there. I never imagined that Finn would not cut it. And they did make a few minor cuts, but, a couple staff people asked me, well, what does this mean? And how are we going to do this and that and the other thing? And I said, listen, I never thought for a minute we'd be in this position. So I haven't thought a lot about how we implement this. I mean, it's frankly wild. And all of the conversations I've had with the Ways and Means staff in the Senate suggest that they are even more supportive of SHPD's budget than Finn was. But it's just remarkable. I was having a lousy week last week until Thursday afternoon. You know, and then Sherry Luke said, well, we're going to add this money for Shipti, and now we're going to add all these positions too. And I was like, interestingly, on the new positions, the 14 new positions, they cut, as I said, they cut one position, but they added more money. You know, I read it. It took Randolph Lee, who some of you may know, it took him going over the budget and saying, no, you're misreading it. They didn't cut the position in the funding. They cut the position and added funding. It was like Christmas morning. Last Thursday afternoon.
It'd be popular, Alan.
either they're really pleased with me or they want to give me enough rope to hang myself. I'm not quite sure which, but
popular to their staff. Nothing like having money to give out.
Yeah. I mean I'm still kind of halfway. I mean, I've got the printout here finally from the finance committee, and I keep looking at it thinking I'm misreading something, but it's a remarkable outcome. So, Laura, do you have your hand up?
Yeah. Yes, I have a quick question. Are of these 14 civil appointments, are they going to be civil service appointments, and also, how are those 14 going to be designated, and what areas are they going to be focused, your staff needs?
Okay, so first of all, they are exempt from civil service. If they were not exempt, we would not be able to adjust the salaries. That would be up to the Department of Human Resources and Development. And, you know, actually was asked this question, well, why don't you, you know, classify them and put them on the you know, they have, DHERD has a list of positions that, you know, you're allowed to hire at above their base pay, and the maximum allowance for those positions, the most, you know, at this point, the most generous is for nurses, and it's a 12% raise. And our positions are between 50 and 80% below the private sector. And so even, you know, if we went that route, we wouldn't be able to give those raises. So they're not civil service. Within DLNR, within the department, that's the salaries is the only difference. DLNR treats all employees as if they are civil service, and whether civil service or not, they're all covered by the union contract. So in terms of the distribution of positions, so there are five additional archaeologists. There are two architectural historians. There is an additional burial site specialist, and an additional position that's described as a cultural historian. They basically do genealogy to support the burial councils. There is a position for a historian, somebody who would meet the requirements of the Secretary of Interior standards, just on history alone. We do have several people with backgrounds in American studies or Hawaiian studies that technically meet the standard, but you know, that's not the work they do in any case. And then there are there's another GIS technician. There are a couple of other administrative positions to support. We've got a couple administrative people who are doing the work of three people. So we asked for two finance. That was the one position that was cut. They cut one of the two administrative support. Administrative specialist, I think, is a job title. And then there's a position, an assistant administrator position. Not an assistant to the administrator, but an assistant administrator. So at least as far as I'm concerned, that's great news. I have nothing more to say. I'm going to take the weekend off now and sort of take another weekend and bask in the glow of this. for those of you who care, the Ways and Means Committee is going to take up the budget on Wednesday. And so just to, for those of you who are not familiar with the process, once Ways and Means passes out their version of the budget, the two committees will get together to try to reach agreement on the points that, so what comes over is a budget, sort of the technical way the process works is with the, House Bill 1600, House Draft 1, which is the version passed by Finance, that comes to Ways and Means. Ways and Means goes through it line by line, and either agrees or, either concurs or does not concur. Where they don't concur with the Fin budget HD1, that will go into there will then be an HB 1600 HD1 SD1 Senate Draft 1, and then the two committees, there will be a conference committee formed with members from both the Ways and Means and the Finance Committee. They will meet from now until the end of the session, until they either can agree on every item in there or just agree that they can't agree and it's done. So there is a long way to go before the final budget is put to a vote on the House and Senate floors. But we're in amazingly good shape. So. But WAM takes it up on Tuesday. They're not, I don't believe they will. Well, I mean, actually, I take that back. They are taking testimony from the public. So if you want to weigh in, if you want to force yourself through the, 600 pages of the state budget and provide your comments to Ways and Means, you can testify either in writing or, either by video or personal presence. The Capitol is now open, and as long as you're vaccinated and show up with a mask, you can sit in and testify in person. So,
Alan, one quick question about that new significance criteria. Is that going to be criterion F?
Well, no, the significance criteria are not in the statute. They're in the rules. So, currently, Chapter 60 HRS defines a historic property as a thing that is over 50 years old. And the change in the definition would be that it is 50 years old and eligible for the Hawaii Register.
I'm talking about the pre-contact archaeological. Oh. Yeah,
I haven't even thought about that. I mean, okay. How we go about implementing that, I'm not sure it requires a rule change, Matt. I think just the statutory change is enough. And if by some chance somebody was foolish enough to damage a property that we could demonstrate was pre-contact, I think just the statutory, definition would be sufficient. I mean, I obviously have to talk to the Attorney General's office about that, but that's my view right now. And as Matt knows, if it really does almost require documentary evidence, because if it comes to, we've got a radiocarbon date or a thermoluminescence date, those are probability dates. They have, so you can never say, it would be very hard to say, convince the Board of Land and Natural Resources, which is what actually issues the fines, that a place was, pre-contact. But,
How about the third party review ones? Are those all dead?
Yeah, that's the third party review is in the bill that would delegate to the counties, and the House version is dead. The Senate version, which went before the House Ways and Means Committee, did cross over, passed out of the Senate, crossed over, and the Water and Land Committee deferred it. And they did not set a, a subsequent date for a hearing on it, on the deferral. So it's, there's still a while yet, but I think it would take somebody, it would take some convincing to get the chair of water and land to bring it back for a hearing, you know, for action. So I'm pretty sure it's dead. As sure as you can ever be until, you know, before adjournment, yeah.
All right, thank you, Dr. Donner.
All right,
okay. Any other comments, questions? Okay, meeting is adjourned and we'll see you on May 19th.
Matt, thank you
so very much, everybody. Have a fabulous weekend.
Good meeting, thanks.
Thank you, Matt.